Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Remember when the tax break was going to bring in loads of revenue? A federal report says revenues are down and the country is facing the debt limit. But Senator Enzi sees things differently.
Federal revenues are ahead. Unfortunately, spending is dramatically ahead.
Wyoming girls are among the first to join the Boy Scouts.
I wanted to join Boy Scouts for my whole life, pretty much.
The Sheridan Wyo Rodeo boasts one race that's called America's Most Extreme Sport.
We've got an event which is not a sanctioned PRCA event, but is sanctioned by the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo, and that's the World Championship Indian Relay Races.
Those stories and the latest on Wyoming's coal industry on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Coal operations in the Powder River Basin are in the midst of a restructuring. Production has been racing downward since 2009, and this year, the brewing trends hit the region hard with a series of dramatic bankruptcies and a merger. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports a new normal is setting in.
In 2015 and 16, three massive coal companies in Wyoming filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy: Arch Coal, Alpha Natural Resources, and Peabody Energy.
The national story was, this is the warning for coal.
That's Rob Godby, a University of Wyoming energy economist. Nearly 500 people were laid off in a day. Workers lost millions of dollars worth of retirement benefits. But Godby says all that wasn't caused by Wyoming coal. This year, though, Godby says, is different. A massive utility is looking to close several Wyoming coal plants early. Arch and Peabody are merging operations to have a better shot against natural gas. And three coal companies, Westmoreland, Cloud Peak Energy, and Black Jewel, went bankrupt. Godby says it's all connected.
The problem here and now is your core business is not nearly as stable.
It's not as if something changed dramatically with coal. Prices certainly didn't. But the world changed around it. Natural gas, wind, and solar became much more competitive for electric utilities, which drove coal production down with it. All of them dropped their generation costs by more than half from a decade ago. This drop in demand pushed three coal companies to a point where they weren't generating enough cash, so they filed for bankruptcy, one based on the weakness of Wyoming thermal coal demand itself. And that makes this year notable, not just to Godby, but financial analysts nationwide. Black Jewel has been a loud showing of the difficulty in finding new investment to run a coal company. Cloud Peak was seen as a great manager. Westmoreland even had a price edge by sitting next to a power plant. And yet, they're all struggling. Here's Rob Godby.
So 2019 should really be considered a watershed year where we're getting a major restructuring of the coal industry in Wyoming and in the Powder River Basin.
Come on forward, please.
Wyoming isn't blind to the changes underway.
Ms. Levin, welcome.
The state's Joint Revenue Committee recently discussed the issue because the decline of coal has a big-time effect on state revenue. The governor's chief of staff, Buck McVeigh, introduced a task force called the Energy Futures Group. It'll look for new revenue streams, perhaps new taxes to fill in the gaps left by coal. He says they need something to happen fast.
We obviously cannot wait 20 years for something like this. We can't wait 10 years. This has to be an endeavor that's going to come together probably within this year.
In a later interview, the governor agreed. There have been steps forward in diversification, but the state will have to speed up. He says he's confident it can happen, though it may not be a smooth transition.
None of that happens overnight. I'm fully anticipating we're going to have a few, hopefully not more than one or two, really pretty tight years. But as we emerge on the other side, I think we're better able to pivot than a lot of other economies.
And he says maybe the time crunch will force positive change.
We tend to have to sort of be pushed to the brink before we appreciate what the opportunities are and the challenges.
Gordon says despite all that, he does expect the coal industry to stabilize. It's always had booms and busts. But Godby, the energy economist, says it's different now. The trend for coal demand isn't expected to rebound. It's been racing downward since 2009. And don't look for great improvement. Based on numbers from a Moody's Investor Service projection, coal production could fall by more than half in the Powder River Basin by 2030, save for some breakthrough in carbon capture or a mandate to end natural gas production. Godby says that's shocking.
Since World War II, the electricity market has been pretty stable. Coal produced most of the energy. And in a decade, that's turned upside down.
Taylor Kirkendall, a coal reporter with S&P Global Market Intelligence, says there is still a place for Powder River Basin coal, but there will be changes.
More and more, we're seeing the coal industry kind of brace to be much smaller than it was in the past.
In other words, consolidate or restructure, something Wyoming has already seen this year, with Arch and Peabody merging 7 of its mines.
Consolidation of that basin would go a long way towards allowing them to negotiate better prices that would support kind of a longer-term health of the companies.
Consolidation will mean huge companies, but it will also mean the loss of smaller companies and mines here today. It will lead to other changes, like maybe taxes or finding new ways to pay for things like education. In Cheyenne, at that joint revenue meeting, Senator Cale Case says they have little choice but to consider new paths.
It doesn't matter whether you're a global warming believer or not. The realism is that the world is changing.
Here's a couple stats. For the first time this year, renewables collectively overtook coal in total electricity generation. And this summer, analysts expect natural gas to be at its lowest price in 20 years. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Experts say federal revenues are down, and lawmakers in Washington are scrambling to find a suitable compromise to avert the nation's first ever default on its debt. Wyoming senators say it's all because the nation spends too much and not because the GOP tax cut is not living up to promises. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has this story from Washington exploring what really happened.
The nation's Treasury Secretary initially thought lawmakers wouldn't have to raise the debt ceiling until October or November, but White House officials have moved that deadline to early September. That's because projected federal revenues are way down, according to the Bipartisan Policy Center, a wonky think tank that tries to avoid the partisan tit-for-tat that's come to mark contemporary politics. That nonpartisan analysis doesn't sit well with Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi, who chairs the Budget Committee. Enzi usually doesn't stop to talk to reporters in the Capitol's halls, but he did when confronted with that analysis.
Wait a minute. Federal revenues are not down. Federal revenues are ahead. Unfortunately, spending is dramatically ahead. We're spending 3 times as much as the extra revenue that's coming in from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We can't keep doing that.
Enzi says the case in point is the debate from earlier this summer over funding natural disasters.
The disaster bill started at $13 billion at the beginning of the week. In order to buy enough votes, it got to $19.1 billion by the end of the week. That's 3 months' worth of revenue off of the increase in revenues.
Enzi's not alone. We hopped on the tram that runs underneath the Capitol with Wyoming Junior Senator John Barrasso. And we asked him why the Trump administration is rushing to make up for a shortfall in federal revenues after he and other party leaders promised revenues would go up under their tax cut package.
It's not that we're taxed too little, it's that we spend too much. People in Wyoming understand that. We balance our budget every year in Wyoming. I think we need a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. I support that. I've introduced and co-sponsored it in the past. But look, if the federal government ran the way Wyoming ran, it would be a lot better for the whole country.
At the start of this year, the director of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, Keith Hall, told lawmakers that the tax bill was falling short of GOP claims that it would pay for itself, which he has since reaffirmed.
Obviously, projecting the future, you can be wrong. We can be wrong. We did a really careful analysis of the tax bill. We looked at research. We tried to base it on real data, real evidence, and our estimate did in fact show that the GDP benefits of the tax bill would increase revenues, but not enough to fully cover the bill, and it covers about 30% of the tax bill.
GOP leaders like Barrasso sold the sweeping tax cut package as a bill that didn't need to be offset elsewhere in the budget because they argued it would pay for itself. For Democrats, like the ranking member on the Senate Appropriations Committee, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand why there's such a steep decline in revenue.
Well, one of the biggest reasons was, of course, the Trump tax cut. I mean, all that money didn't create really any new jobs. The corporations used it for stock buybacks, made a whole lot of people wealthy.
To more moderate Democrats, like Delaware Senator Tom Carper, it's not simply an either-or question.
Do we need to watch the spending? And yes. Do we need more revenues? We need both.
Carper says that's partly why the GOP needs to agree to hike taxes, even just a tad, or else he knows his party won't budge on its preferred spending priorities.
I think at the end of the day, if we're serious about making progress, it has to be both. And if it's not both, then there's not an incentive for the Democrats to go along.
Partisan politics aside, Senator Enzi says he's working on potential budget reforms that could help avoid situations like this in the future. For years, he's pushed party leaders to move to two-year budgets, like they do in Wyoming, along with a number of other sweeping reform proposals. And now that Enzi's retiring, he says more lawmakers are willing to embrace some of his ideas.
And I'm having some bipartisan success on that, maybe because I'm not running. But at any rate, some of it probably won't take effect until after the next election. That's when neither side knows who the president's going to be, neither side knows who the majorities are going to be, so both sides are being reasonable. And it's the prime time to get something in place that will protect your generation and future generations from this heavily increasing debt.
While Enzi won't get into all the details because negotiations are still ongoing, he is vowing to leave Washington with a budgetary bang.
I'm going to have to create a verbal crisis here to get my colleagues to come along. And it's not just verbal, it's real.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, two stories about the lack of affordable housing in regional communities of Jackson, Wyoming and Moab, Utah. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Summer's in full swing, and that means vacation time. More visitors than ever are flocking to resort towns throughout our region, but that's adding pressure on a housing crunch that's already had local residents scrambling. KUER's Claire Jones reports on what this looks like in the desert destination of Moab.
It's a recent Tuesday evening in June, and Ryan Hules is finishing up a trail run after a 12-hour nursing shift at Moab Regional Hospital.
I run here every day, pretty much, after work at least. It's right on the way home and go for a quick run and not see any people.
The 24-year-old has been looking for jobs in small western towns, ideally with easy outdoor access. There was an opening in Moab, which checked most of his boxes. A quick drive later, and Hules is arriving home. Inside are familiar photos of iconic places near Moab, Delicate Arch, Mesa Arch. There's a leather couch and a big screen TV, but none of it belongs to him.
The only thing that's mine really is the desk, some of the plants in the window, that Be Free sign, a lot of the books.
Hules is lucky to have found this place, and for $6.25 a month, it's affordable. That's hard to come by in Moab. According to a study from Headwaters Economics, more than half of the residents here spend a third of their income or more on rent. But he won't be living here for long. This duplex is owned by the hospital where he works, and they gave him until November to find a new home.
We have people that want to move here. They have the job, and there's nowhere to live.
That's Catherine Sullivan, the director of human resources at Moab Regional Hospital. She says the lack of housing is making it hard to fill jobs, some of which have been open for 4 months. So they've taken matters into their own hands. The hospital purchased 5 units, including Hules, to provide transitional housing for new hires.
It's not a cheap solution to the problem, but neither is turnover and nor are vacant positions.
The consensus here is that the affordable housing problem has only gotten worse in the last decade, though the local housing authority doesn't keep data on that. Part of the problem is there isn't much land to develop here. Moab's an old mining town, flanked by Red Rock Canyons and surrounded by public lands. And for decades, it's had a boom-bust economy. The latest boom started in 2013 with some help from the State Office of Tourism.
Picture this, your next trip, Utah, 5 national parks.
This national ad campaign, in combination with low gas prices and a strong U.S. economy, led to a 50% increase in tourists to the area. That's driven demand for more overnight rentals and fewer housing options for residents like Huell's. But he is sympathetic.
All the tourists are here for the same reason that I'm here, is to like enjoy the crazy weird place that it is.
Around 5,000 people live in Moab year-round. But during the busy season, that number can double with tourists. That worries Moab Police Chief Brett Edge. His department has struggled to staff the police force, and part of the reason is the lack of affordable housing. So, Edge includes a driving tour of housing options when interviewing prospective officers.
Can I sit in the front?
Yeah, absolutely.
He turns down a street with a dozen homes, some of which could use a fresh coat of paint.
Like, you look at them and they're nice houses, but they're not, you don't look at it and go, that's a $500,000 house, but they are.
Edge has been the chief since April. The previous chief, Jim Winder, left the force earlier this year because even he couldn't find housing to meet his family's needs. Winder started the driving tours, and Edge adopted the tactic so prospects know the situation.
It'll either be people who are like, I still want to come to Moab, or they're like, I'm not even going to waste your time.
Councilwoman Tawny Knutson-Boyd says this is not a new problem. The town struggled with affordable housing when her father-in-law was mayor in the 1960s. But in the 80s, when uranium mining slowed down, Moab experienced a bust.
Windows were boarded up and houses were closed, and we certainly don't want to go back.
Boyd says people have cautioned city officials not to put the brakes on tourism. But for newer residents, tourism is overwhelming. Boyd says that the responsibility to manage it falls on more than just the city council.
It falls on the state, it falls on the Office of Tourism, the hoteliers, the independent business people, it falls on the people of our community.
Moab officials have taken some action. They banned all overnight rentals in residential zones last year. And there's a moratorium on any new overnight rental development until August. Boyd says if it were easy, it would have been fixed. And it's not fixed, which leaves people like Huell's to weigh their options.
I was pretty heavily considering just like either getting a small little camper or just like if I had to, I could just sleep down by the river.
He's hoping something affordable becomes available soon. But across Moab, hotel signs light up and flags for new luxury condos flap in the wind. Claire Jones, KUER News.
In Jackson Hole, some visitors describe the surrounding landscape as God's country. If you ask residents, you might hear them call it poverty with a view. Either way, Jackson Hole is the most economically unequal place in the country. With summer tourists pouring into the region, Robin Vincent tells us how residents in Paradise are tackling their housing crisis.
Look at what a great neighborhood it is. There's awesome people that live here. And it's
Teton County Sheriff Matt Carr is walking through the 3-bedroom house he bought last year. It's just steps from Jackson Hole Mountain Resort's renowned ski runs.
I started out here, 25 years ago when I first moved to Jackson, and so now it's kind of coming full circle.
His house has an open floor plan, vaulted ceilings, and hardwood floors, all kissed with afternoon sun. It's a big change from his living situation just a few years ago.
I was in a 1-bedroom at the time with 2 kids, and it's not a real easy situation, especially as the kids get older.
In 2015, Carr was a lieutenant in the sheriff's office. He was working several jobs to make ends meet and living in the last affordable rental complex in the valley. The housing crisis had reached a tipping point. And then Carr learned his rent was going up by 40%.
So that was why I was fortunate to get in and, with the housing authority.
That changed everything. Homes in his area start at $1 million. But with the help of government-subsidized housing, he paid just $313,000. Carr's story is emblematic of Jackson's housing progress. It has made strides to house local workers, especially critical service providers.
We've been under tremendous pressure as a town council to do something about it.
That's Jackson Town Councilman Jim Stanford. He is one of 2 council members living in a home through Jackson's affordable housing program. The other is the mayor.
What we've seen since the recession was this enormous amount of economic activity and even more economic pressure on our community, housing being priced so far out of reach.
Some factors have deepened that crisis. Wyoming has no state income tax, so it draws in wealthy people from all over. Then there's the lack of developable land. 97% of it is federally protected. Demand has driven up the median price for a home here to $2.3 million. That's unthinkable for civil servants like Carr. He was making 90 grand as an undersheriff when he qualified for his home in Teton Village. But many are left out in the cold, literally.
Can I offer you water? I've got like hummus and chips.
The fridge in John Slaughter's art studio is stocked. He's done a few things to make his shared art studio feel like a home. Perhaps because the 36-year-old photographer doesn't have one.
It's definitely hard, especially when I just had two nice living situations recently.
For the last 6 years, Slaughter has lived in his van in the summers. During Jackson's frigid winters, he has found temporary housing. This past winter, he almost found the stability of a real home. But it was a short-lived
handshake deal. I was there for about 10 months, so that was kind of the longest stint.
For residents like Slaughter, the jackpot is Jackson's housing lottery. It prioritizes people based on length and type of employment or income. Some have been waiting for years. But Slaughter doesn't fit neatly into those categories. He is part of Jackson's shrinking creative class. A lot of those folks have already left.
There's no silver bullet to this problem.
That's April Norton, director of the Jackson-Teton County Affordable Housing Department. She notes the housing department has more than 100 units in development. Still, the percentage of workers living locally is trending slightly down. Norton points to two reasons.
One, we have a lot of people who are retiring.
And selling their homes for millions. Then there's the local job growth rate. It's 3.5%, nearly double the national average.
It's really hard to keep up with that.
For the sheriff, it's also difficult to give his deputies the stability he now has. Housing county employees was central to Carr's campaign when he ran for sheriff last year. Of his 25 patrollers, 5 live in Teton County. All are in units through the housing department. For the rest, they live at least one mountain pass away. Councilman Stanford says that distance worries him and others.
At a certain point, you're not going to have anybody to help you. You're not going to have anybody to serve you. You're not going to have anybody to respond when you're in an emergency.
Elected officials have taken more drastic measures to address the housing issue in the last year. Developers now must provide or pay housing costs for a larger proportion of their full-time workers. But Sheriff Carr's deputies, they haven't gotten the housing allowances he wants. Instead, the county last month voted to raise nearly all its employees' salaries. Still, Carr says it's too little, too late.
It's really hard for our officers that don't live here. Their kids don't go to school here. They don't grocery shop here.
In other words, they have no connection to the community they serve, keeping Carr awake at night. Robin Vincent, KUER News.
Both of those stories come courtesy of KUER in Salt Lake City. When we come back, we will have the next edition of our Belonging series. And some Wyoming girls are entering the Boy Scouts. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today, we bring you the second installment of our Belonging series. Around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave the state each year. So Wyoming Public Radio has turned the microphone over to young people to talk about what's behind their decisions to stay or go. Though they have felt like outsiders at times, Alan Pino and Catalina Pedroza, who are both pursuing careers as educators, feel a strong sense of loyalty to Wyoming. They sat down to discuss racial identity and how Wyoming stereotypes can be at odds with a vision of a state full of potential.
I remember being in kindergarten, and the kids were like, oh, you're Mexican. They very clearly labeled that to me, and I'm like,
oh, I am Mexican. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But there's always been that going through my life in Wyoming, which is understandable because there's not a lot of people of color in the state of Wyoming.
Yeah, it's really hard because we are the minority.
But it becomes a little problematic because people thought I was supposed to be as Mexican as possible. Mm. I never went to a quinceanera. I don't know.
Quinceanera?
Quinceanera. Yeah, clearly. But that's what people thought who I was from Wyoming, right. At least. At times I don't feel like I belong in Wyoming, but then I do feel like I belong in Wyoming because I identify with the state.
It's like you're not American enough to be American, or you're not Mexican enough to be Mexican. And so we kind of live this in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So why stay in Wyoming?
I think living in Wyoming is wonderful. Went to Casper College, then to the University of Wyoming. I was a communication major. And so I was constantly thinking about, am I going to live in Wyoming or not live in Wyoming? I love Wyoming. I love the atmosphere. It's not the big town or big city or anything like that. It's very small. But if I want to have a career that's, I guess, larger than a Wyoming life, it would automatically take me outside of the state. And eventually what ended up winning out was the side of me that's like, I care about my family too much and I love Wyoming so much. But on the career path, that's where things didn't work out. And so now I'm changing and trying to do education. What about you?
I mean, I found my place in education. I just graduated from the University of Wyoming in elementary education, and so I want to get back. Wyoming as a whole, I felt there's a lot of opportunity here. That's why I wanted to stay in Wyoming. It's a beautiful, full of opportunity kind of state. Going from a couple of different school systems, I don't really remember Georgia, but Texas and then moving to Evanston, I had such a wonderful educational career, especially moving to Cheyenne, to East High School. I just bloomed and flourished. This district in particular, I don't know about other Wyoming districts, puts a lot of money into kids traveling outside the state to experience different things. And I can't say that a lot of school districts in America do that.
So this kind of extends to like the Wyoming identity. This is the part of the Wyoming identity that makes me most upset. We're both coaching the speech and debate team, and so we get the opportunity to work with a lot of students. But when they go to the national level, they potentially have this idea of, I'm from Wyoming, I'm not supposed to win this. The kid from New York, the kid from California, the kid from Florida is supposed to win this. How is a kid like me from Wyoming supposed to win this?
Right.
And like, I think that even extends in all aspects of the younger generation coming from Wyoming. I don't think there's any truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, so you just talked about the resources at our disposal. Those are resources people from other states don't get.
No.
And like, it makes me so mad because it's this like weird self-fulfilling prophecy that we have created, that I'm from Wyoming, I'm not going to be amazing. The Wyoming identity may be in transition right now, but it's definitely coming at a conflict of, do we stay this very small state getting the opportunity to be in a town where you know everyone? Or do we start, let's build, let's grow, and let's start changing the identity of Wyoming? Any thoughts?
I don't know. A lot of Wyoming's identity is tied to the oil fields and the boom and bust of this economic position that we're in. My father moved to Evanston for an oil position, and so he's been working in the oil fields for a very long time. And then he lost his job. And so I've seen that disparity of, like, what do I do now? Like, my whole life was the oil field, and where do I go? I have all of this experience in oil. Do I move? A lot of people have these conversations. And so is that going away from the boom and bust system? Is that going to a city and finding, I don't know, a higher paying job? As Wyoming, like, what are they doing to keep jobs here? Or what are people looking for when they come to the Wyoming life?
Wyoming life is like people around the U.S. and even the world, they think about cowboys and they think about Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And then so like 18 to 24, it's like, do you want to be a cowboy or do you want to go to Yellowstone?
Well, when I think of 18 to 24 year olds, I think of technology. I think of a growing industry in green energy. That creates jobs. We could be setting the example of what every state could be doing because we're very small.
That's Catalina Pedroza speaking with Alan Pino for our series Belonging. Charles Fournier produced this piece.
Wyoming is known as the Equality State, so it's fitting that earlier this year, one of its Boy Scout troops was amongst the first in the country to induct girls. The national organization changed its policy in February to be more inclusive. Since then, Troop 221 in Cheyenne has already seen its female scout numbers double. Wyoming Public Radio's Mackie Mullen caught up with some of those scouts at their recent badge ceremony.
In a church banquet room in Cheyenne, a group of scouts is nervously chatting before the big ceremony.
I'm normally pretty calm, but today I'm doing the flags, so I'm kind of nervous.
That's 11-year-old Samantha Hurst, who goes by Sammy.
And what does that mean to do the flags?
So I call out like what the color guard's supposed to be doing.
That means she's at the front of the room, directing the scouts who'll present the troop's flag along with the American flag during the ceremony. While Sammy stands there, her dad adjusts her uniform by rolling up its sleeves. The family is about to move across the country, and the box with her scout uniform accidentally got put onto the moving truck a little too soon. So she's borrowing a uniform that's about four sizes too big.
I'm just tying her a neckerchief slide so it will slide up and look right.
Her dad, James Hurst, was an Eagle Scout as a kid, so he knows how things should look.
Identifies them with their troop by the logo that's on it.
So it's a Troop 221.
Yes.
The girls' logo is 221G and the boys' 221B. And this badge ceremony is one of the few activities they actually do together. So if they're still separate most of the time, why do girls want to join a boys' troop? Sammy Hurst says she grew out of Girl Scouts.
I did it and I got to a junior and I thought this is a lot of like arts and crafts and like cooking and sewing and stuff. And I wanted more, let's go outside and be adventurous, you know?
Girls Troop leader Valerie Merriman Fish says today's ceremony is a big deal since this is when scouts receive their badges.
Like this time around, we have 102 to give out tonight.
Wow. Yes. That seems like a lot.
It is a lot. So we have a good group of both the boys and the girls, and they just work their little rears off.
This part of scouts isn't new. Just like before, scouts earn badges by learning new skills or completing goals. And Scout Sammy Harris has been busy. These are some of the badges she'll take home tonight.
Archery, citizenship in the world, environmental science, and soil and water conservation.
It's subjects like these that attracted 17-year-old Taylor Fawcett. She also says Girl Scouts just didn't cut it for her.
I wanted to join Boy Scouts for my whole life, pretty much, because I did Girl Scouts, and it's basically like turning you into a 50s housewife. I enjoyed it, but like, I really enjoy this because it's outdoors and you get to do camping and hiking and stuff like that.
Fawcett says she was specifically interested in earning the Water and Soil Conservation Badge before she goes off to college next year.
Especially like rangeland conservation, that's what I want to be doing.
Soon it's time for the ceremony. Everybody takes their seats as Sammy Hurst walks to the front of the room to lead the color guard.
Audience, troop attention.
Everybody then stands up out of their seats.
Color guard forward march.
Two scouts carry the two flags towards the front of the room. They follow Sammy's instructions to hang the flags, then everybody joins her in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic.
There's a short skit, prayer, and then the scout oath.
On my honor.
On my honor. There is a good word to start out with. It comes from the French.
A candle is lit for each of the 12 segments of the Scout Oath. It includes things like to be helpful by volunteering to help others without expecting a reward and to be brave when facing difficult situations, even when you feel afraid. Then each scout is called to the front to receive their badges, each of them a little shy but beaming with pride. Next week, it's back to scouting. For Sammy Hurst, who's moving across the country, that means a new Boys and Girls Scout troop in Alabama. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
In her newest book, Wyoming author Mary Billiter takes the life-altering mental health issues faced by her actual son and turns the experience into a work of fiction. A Divided Mind is a story told through the eyes of Tara and her son Branson as they confront the voices and hallucinations taking over his mind. Billiter consulted her son Kyle Thomas throughout the writing process. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson sat down with them to learn more.
Where were the two of you at with your own experience when this book idea emerged?
Yeah, that's a great question. What happened was Kyle came to me his senior year in high school and said he was hearing voices. And my first instinct was, as a mom, was to make him go away. And his first instinct was to find out what was going on. So, of course, we traveled this course. I mean, the very next day I had him into an emergency intake session. And we were in Casper at the time. And I was writing for the Casper Star Tribune. I was this career journalist, and I just started asking questions because I just couldn't understand any of this. It was just such a, like, what do you mean you're hearing voices? Like, what does that look like? What happens? And as I started asking, and he was just such great feedback, this story would not be what it is without Kyle. There's no way I could get into Branson's head if Kyle hadn't let me into his. So it was just, it started from really a quest for answers, like what's going on. And then I had my own emotions tied up in it. And it was kind of our journey at the time.
And I wonder, what does it feel like to see that experience rendered as a work of fiction?
So it was very interesting to go through it and just kind of relive these moments and remind myself of what had happened and
And how far you've come, too.
Yes.
How much growth there has been. That this was 4 years ago, senior year in high school, and Kyle just graduated from the University of Wyoming in May. So 4 years later, four-year degree. I mean, this is, again, the hope about mental illness is not the end for somebody.
So you mentioned your instincts as a journalist, and I'm wondering, why not do this as a work of nonfiction, or what were you able to tackle that you wouldn't have been able to take on in nonfiction?
When I'm writing fiction, I control the content. I get to know just how far into our lives you go. So while I open us up a lot, I still have that precipice of where I'm like, I won't go that far, you know? So fiction is this great world where I can, plus Tara got to have some amazing shoes and a way better car than I had. So, you know, she got to.
I did notice that.
She did have some. I had some liberties there. But, you know, I got to have. There was things that Tara got to do that I didn't have the freedom or the resources to do. So I was able to have, you know, that was fun to live in that world. That was fun to live in that world.
Well, I want to take us to maybe a less fun part of that world. And Mary, I wanted to ask you to read a passage from the book. And it's a scene where Branson, the son, he comes home late after hitting a cat with his car. And I have to say, I found it to be a particularly heartbreaking scene because they both really need something and they're not able to give it to each other.
Agreed. Okay, here we go. The porch light was on, and even though the blinds in the front room were drawn, I could see the faint flicker of another light shining inside. Mom. My throat tightened. I held my keys tightly and stood outside my house. I can't do this. I can't tell her about the woman or the cat or how it's getting worse. She doesn't deserve this. I swallowed hard and placed my key into the lock, barely opening the door before she was in front of me. Branson? Her voice was the sound of home. It was enough to buckle me, but I couldn't. Instead, I cocked my head. What? She shook her head. I just wanted to make sure you're okay. For Christ's sakes, I hit a cat. It's not that big a deal. Okay. Now she sounded wounded. Listen, I said with an edge to my voice. I'm tired and I just want to go to bed. I can't do this right now. Her eyes softened. The green reminded me of String Lake in Jackson, a fishing spot where we used to go with my dad. The water was warm and a greenish blue that was impossible not to stare into, let alone want to touch. I wanted to reach out to her to be held, for her to tell me everything was going to be okay, that I wasn't alone, that I'd never be alone, that she'd make this all go away. I just shook my head. I'm going to bed. Okay, she said with a weak attempt at a smile. Good night. I brushed past her as she called out my name. I turned and exhaled. What? Love you.
That scene for me posed a question about how we get past that when fear is motivating how we're treating each other and we lose some of that intimacy and vulnerability. And I think the book offers some really incredible ideas about how you do that.
Yeah, so we kind of had to work up to that. I mean, my mom and I have always been close, but mental illness to me, I had no idea what was going on. And it was just kind of a huge, I just kind of, whenever I had a problem with myself, I usually dealt with it by myself, which was very unhealthy. And I think it even worsened my symptoms. So I think the best thing you can do is either talk to someone, whether it's a counselor, a family member, but just coming out with it, it relieves so much stress off your personal life. Just to share that information with someone else and to get the help that you need. I know a lot of people that are undiagnosed and that they keep this all to themselves, believing that they're just bothering people who are going through mental illness. And I just think that opening up to my mom and writing this book together and her asking questions of what was going on in my life and the symptoms I was, it was just kind of a relief to talk about what I was going through with someone that I trusted. Doing that has just helped me tremendously, and this book was just it was a great way to talk about my symptoms and everything.
Well, your book, A Divided Mind, comes out on July 27th from Tangled Tree Publishing. And Mary Billiter and Kyle Thomas, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Barnes & Noble in Cheyenne is hosting a Divided Mind book signing with the author on August 3rd.
In a moment, we will wrap up the program with a story about a new dinosaur exhibit and learn about the Indian relays at the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. A newly identified species has taken up residence at the Wyoming Dinosaur Center in Thermopolis. Paleontologists say that the 3-foot-tall creature is the smallest dinosaur ever discovered in the state. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports, it could hold the key to understanding how today's birds evolved to fly.
Spanning the entire length of the Wyoming Dinosaur Center's main exhibit hall is the state's preeminent dino celebrity.
So this is Jimbo right here. He stretches about 106 feet long.
That's Jessica Lippincott, a paleontologist and the Dinosaur Center's education director. She says that Jimbo the Supersaurus is the largest dinosaur ever discovered in North America. And in 2001, when scientists were excavating his bones from a quarry in Douglas, Wyoming, they came across something else.
She was found kind of accidentally because we were removing overburden from the main Jimbo bone layer. And so about 10 centimeters up from that bone layer, she was uncovered.
Her name is Hesperornithides meisleri. You can call her Lori. A team of scientists from Wisconsin, Washington State, the UK, and the Wyoming Dinosaur Center officially named and identified her in a journal article published last week. But even if this is the first you're hearing of Lori, you might be familiar with some of her relatives.
So probably the most famous or would be Velociraptor, just because of Jurassic Park and Jurassic World.
Like the tiny but vicious antagonists of the 1993 film, Lori had a sharp claw on each of her feet. But the paleontologists who study her say she wasn't quite as fearsome looking.
If you picture a chicken, add a tail on the chicken, and then transform the beak to a toothy snout, that's pretty much what it would look like.
Dean Lomax is part of the team of scientists that spent the past 4 years coming up with that description and figuring out what Lori's life might have been like during the late Jurassic period, about 140 million years ago.
It would have been running around a wetland environment and feasting on all the tiny little animals there. So from insects to small mammals to lizards and possibly very small dinosaurs.
Because of the family of dinosaurs that Lori belongs to, Lomax and the rest of the team believe she had feathers, and that's important. It tells us that today's birds might have evolved from ground dwellers like Lori, as well as from climbing dinosaurs that spent most of their time in trees.
So it shows that although this animal didn't fly, its descendants presumably would have evolved flight at some point. And it shows that the evolution of flight and feathers themselves evolved in several different dinosaurs. It wasn't a straight arrow.
The research team says that Lori fills an evolutionary gap between the Velociraptor and Archaeopteryx, an avian reptile seen as the transitional between dinosaurs and modern birds. And unlike many of the most famous dinosaur specimens discovered in the state, Lori is staying right here in Wyoming. That's a particular point of pride for Bill Wall, a paleontologist who was there at the dig site when Lori was discovered.
Rather than this going to the Smithsonian, rather than this going to the American Museum of Natural History, we would like to keep it here. So literally at the case downstairs, you can stand at one case and look at Archaeopteryx, the Hesperornithoides specimens, and Velociraptor. So you're looking at an entire timeline and evolutionary process all within about 10 or 15 feet.
Wall says he hopes Lori's discovery will prompt universities and museums to look through their collections for specimens that might match, and to keep an eye out for pint-sized fossils when they're digging for dinosaurs. After all, Lori was discovered by accident, by paleontologists digging up an animal a few hundred times her size.
We're trying to rebuild, little by little, a lost world. I mean, not to make it sound too corny or anything, but it's just getting enough information from small-scale pieces of an environment to build a better picture.
And if scientists around the world want to study Lori, they'll have to travel here to Thermopolis, where her bones, teeth, and that infamous killing claw are all on permanent display. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
For 89 years, the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo has drawn big crowds to the city's fairgrounds. But one exciting event in particular is known to keep them coming back every year. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on what many say is North America's most extreme sport.
Now, how many of you enjoyed the Indian reeling?
The Sheridan Wyo Rodeo dates all the way back to 1931, and Sheridan County Commissioner and Rodeo Board Member Emeritus Tom Ringley says locals got the idea during the years of the Great Depression.
They wanted some activity for the town because it was just dead as a doornail.
But its most famous event has only been around for 23 years.
We've got an event which is not a sanctioned PRCA event, but is sanctioned by the Sheridan Wyo Rodeo, and that's the World Championship Indian Relay Races.
Sean Realbird is the Indian Events Coordinator for the rodeo. He says the sport originates with Plains Native American tribes stealing horses when they were at war with each other.
When they steal these horses, the horse that they rode would be played out, and they would jump on another horse, and they would do that all the way back home. And so that's where the Indian relay started.
Realbird says they brought this tradition to reservations and competitors raced around on an oval. In the 1990s, Sheridan Rodeo officials asked Realbird if there were some Native American events that could make their rodeo more exciting because attendance was going down.
Because if they didn't bring back the Native events, there was a possibility that they would have to cancel it because of the low fan base.
And Realbird says the Indian relay races caught on quickly.
There they go! In the middle of the track.
A race has a lot of moving parts. There are teams of four people, a rider and three others that control and stop the horses. And the rider starts by jumping onto the horse and rides bareback. After each lap, riders have to jump off the moving horse and jump onto a new one for a total of three laps. This can lead to a lot of chaos.
The wrecks and the excitement all happen when you're switching horses, because the other horse from another team could run into you, you could run into another team, you could fall off your horse, and they don't have no saddle, and they're riding bareback, and they're riding full speed.
They just cost themselves a chance to win the title. Will, what do you think about that?
Realbird says not only is the race the most exciting sport in America, but it's also a way to preserve Native American culture and traditions.
Many, many years, it was not good to be an American Indian. But today, with organizations like the Professional Cowboys Association supporting Indian Relay, that we can bring this Native culture to the forefront. We could bring it and display it for all the world to see.
Realbird even made a rule that riders have to wear traditional dress, and riders paint themselves and their horses with traditional designs.
They take great pride in their teams. I didn't foresee that these team members would all be utilizing a uniform. with native designs on them. They would, even now, some of the teams would come out with moccasins, and some of the teams would even come out with war bonnets.
And of course they win prize money. Riobert says the Indian relays go beyond just the Sheridan Rodeo. There's a circuit and competitions all over the country. Riobert invites all tribal nations to compete in the Sheridan race. He says that most participants live on reservations and that the competitions have had a positive impact. Paul Nomi is a competitor for the Alligator Creek team that comes from the Crow Reservation. He says he loves the fast pace of the sport.
Yeah, that brings a lot of excitement too. A lot of competition and big crowds. I think this one's probably the most extreme sport.
Tom Ringley of the Rodeo Board says the Indian relays are a vital part of what makes the Sheridan Wayo Rodeo great.
It's become an integral part of the rodeo. I can't imagine not having it.
On Saturday, the Mountain Crow team that represents the Crow Nation took the top prize after 4 days of competition. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
And I'll tell you, that was outstanding.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear an individual segment, hear the show online, or past programs, you can find it at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can also sign up for our podcast on that site or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Please support Wyoming Public Radio News with your pledge today through our website. We rely on your support to bring you this high-quality coverage. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.